everyone, and welcome back to the Strike and Ellicott Files, an unofficial podcast dedicated to all things Cormoran Strike and Robin Ellicott, as written by Robert Galbraith. My name is Kenz.
I'm Lindsay.
And I'm Pulse.
And today we'll be continuing our reread of The Running Grave, covering chapters 67 through 70 of Part 5. Please be aware, as always, that our discussion of The Running Grave will often reference the ending of this book, as well as the previous books in the series. But before we get started, we have so much news.
So much news. And very exciting.
Yes. I am so excited. We got, the day before we recorded this, the title of book 8.
Oh my God.
Oh my God.
The Hallmarked Man.
What a name.
Wow. How are we even going to start? How are we going to approach this? Like, what do we even...
We just all start screaming?
Screaming internally. Obviously, I spent most of yesterday doing that.
Mm-hmm. Definitely.
As one does.
She was very kind to do this right before we were recording.
Yeah. Very thoughtful. Very thoughtful. Thank you, Joe.
Thank you. Yeah.
She gave us so much, like not even just the title, so much stuff. We just had to keep adding on to these notes.
I know. I just checked chaos. Again right now before we started to make sure there was nothing else.
The Hallmarked Man.
The Hallmarked Man. We have some thoughts. Let's start with Hallmark because it's not just a channel with cheesy movies, right? Or greeting cards.
It's true. Not. I think that this is likely to mean Hallmarked in the sense of an official mark put on gold or silver items by their maker to guarantee their authenticity, their quality, which fits with how Jo tweeted it, right? Because she put a picture of this beautiful silver bracelet that she got with the crest of Sark. Two lions in a heart.
Lions. Are we back at lions?
Yeah.
Okay. Here's my question, though, because when you click on the link or whatever for the bracelet, it says that there are two leopards. Is there something that I'm missing?
It's confusing. I went down this rabbit hole, too, and I am still confused because some places say it, Crest of Sark, two lions taken from Normandy. Some people are like, these lions are leopards. What I've been able to figure out is this, so lions that are depicted walking sideways instead of in profile with their faces towards the viewer, so like this, are called leopards for some reason.
That's very weird.
But they've got manes like lions. Huh. And some sources do say that they call them like lions passant gardant. And apparently there was some confusion because in the medieval age, they thought that leopards were half lion.
I think what you're talking about with an official mark on gold or silver is the correct way to view this, especially given the other news we're going to talk about soon.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. My question would be, is what would make a man hallmarked? Assuming that this isn't referencing some sort of gold or silver statue, right? Because that's also possible, I suppose.
Yeah, it is.
If it's an actual man, the first thing that comes to mind for me is a tattoo or branding of some sort.
It would have to be a mark that signifies his quality or his provenance somehow to be a hallmark. So not just any mark.
Right. But could one of those things not mean that?
Absolutely, it could. Maybe like a regimental tattoo from the army or like a branding of AAA man meat, like sexy BDE brand. I don't know.
I don't know what just happened, but yes, something.
AAA man meat.
Right.
That is something you just said out loud.
Maybe Strike has one right on the butt.
Thinking about Strike.
Right on the butt cheek.
Thinking like if anyone's going to be AAA honka man meat.
It's a tattoo we don't know he has.
When he said that he didn't have any tattoos, he just meant none that are visible.
Right, exactly.
Oh man, I swear all of this talk of tattoos and stuff is just giving me flashbacks to when we were making predictions for Ink Black Heart.
Why did we? Oh, because ink. Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. It still could be though.
6-8 parallels. Ink could be coming
back.
Maybe
we'll get tattoos there we go. This time.
So, and then this morning we got another hint, which was the three emojis to describe the book.
Oh, thank you, Patricio, for asking for this.
Thank you very much. Silver chains, a DNA, and then a skull. Very interesting.
Yes.
Yeah.
So the DNA could relate to like a question of family or inheritance, maybe like ancestry DNA.
I think what you really mean is that Bijou is clearly going to make a reappearance where we find out that she's pregnant with Strike's kid, right?
I swear to
no,
God,
no, it's not Bijou. It's Shauna.
It's Shauna. Shauna. Triple bluff. It's Shauna who's pregnant. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah, we knew. We knew it.
We knew that.
We called it. Yeah, definitely not anything related to the case. Like, it's always been, just so you know, tongue firmly in cheek.
Sarcasm is happening.
Yeah, that is heavy sarcasm in case you didn't pick up on that. But anyway, yeah, I think that you're right. And I do wonder, just because the case ties into the personal, I do wonder whether or not that's also going to point to some stuff with Rokeby or maybe Ted.
Yeah, maybe. I was really hoping for Ellicott family instead this book.
I don't see why we can't have both. I mean, Troubled Blood had both.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. You're right. But then going back to the beginning of the emoji chain, the chains. Mm. So I've seen some people on Twitter suggest that the chains combined with a ship, which is the other clue we got, made some people think there might be a connection to like slavery somehow. But the chains could also be metaphorical, like you're chained to your DNA or your family, or used in a different context, or supposed to represent literal silver links in some kind of necklace, right?
Oh yeah, that'd be good.
And the skull, I mean, there's going to be a dead person.
That's a pretty probably safe bet.
There's going to be a murder.
So putting these together, I'm like, is someone killed for the family silver or something?
I think that the emojis are probably case related. I think we've seen that with the last two. I had this idea already happening yesterday, but these emojis just kind of reinforced my thinking that there will be some sort of unidentified victim. So my thinking from these emojis is that a body is found, maybe locked up, and it could be so decomposed that they can't identify it yet.
Yeah.
And Joe liked your tweet that you posted about that, didn't you?
I did. I said that it was making me think that there's an unidentified victim, and she liked it. She could just be liking, you know, responses.
I hope you're right.
Even without the emojis, it instantly reminded me of the Somerton Man. Do you guys know the Somerton Man?
Yeah.
So in 1948, the body of a well-dressed man was found on a beach in Adelaide and was never identified. What makes me think of him as hallmarked, if you will, is that a piece of paper was found in his pocket with a Persian phrase. I won't try to say it because I won't be able to, but it means...
Wasn't it like Tamanshud or Tamanshud?
I don't know. I'm not going to be able to say it. It means it is over, it is finished. And then the following month, they found a suitcase that belonged to him, and all of his identifying information had been removed from all his clothing, which was a common practice at the time. So it's just been this massive mystery for so many years because they don't know who he is, they don't know how he died, why that phrase was placed in his pocket, why his identifying information had been removed.
I thought I read that they solved this recently.
So in 2022, they used DNA from a hair that they found. Yeah, and they traced it through genealogy. So they're calling it a potential identification, but it has not been confirmed by the police yet.
Oh, okay, I see.
As far as I could find online. So yeah, I really think that it's possible that there could be some sort of unidentified victim with some sort of mark on him. You know, Strike and Robin would have to first discover the identity before they could even start investigating who killed him.
That would be really interesting. I would love a John Doe mystery.
Yeah, it'd be good.
That would be really cool. We haven't had that yet, have we?
No.
The only question, how the hell would Strike and Robin get involved in the investigation? I was wondering if maybe it could be the opposite. They get hired by a family to find a missing person who has an identifying mark?
I mean, I don't know. There are a lot of ways they could get brought in, I guess. I mean, look at how they were involved with Edie's death. You know, I don't think we could have predicted that. It could be that the police haven't had any leads and somehow they get hired. I know the police have access to DNA, but you still have to have something to match that DNA to. And genealogy connections didn't start happening until 2018 when they caught the Golden State Killer. We're still just like a year behind.
Yeah, that's true. If their DNA wasn't in the system, you know, it'd be cool if they ran the guy's DNA and it turned up as the DNA of from an unsolved crime. And then they're like, who killed this criminal? That would be cool. So my prediction, and I feel like this fits with that thought, my prediction when we had Louise on, Louise Freeman, was that we would get a single male victim killed by another man in some kind of professional context. And I gotta say, I feel like the title supports this.
Could it be a criminal professional?
A criminal profession, exactly what I'm thinking.
It could be. It's been a while since we had a male victim. Well, sort of. I mean, there was Josh and Vikas, but, you know, the starting victim.
Victim prime. Yeah.
Not since Lethal White, I think.
Yeah.
That was my first thought, too, that it's a man, obviously. Yeah. If the title is referencing the victim, that I think it's sense. A safe guess that it's a man. Yeah.
Well, yeah.
We're out here making genius predictions.
Yep.
I made that prediction before this dropped, and I want that on the record.
I'm just...
But yeah, there are so many theories we could come up with.
Mm-hmm.
I was talking about it with people on Discord, and Miss Divine said that this title could refer to themes of fakeness and authenticity because of the hallmark being a stamp.
Yeah, I like that.
Now, apparently the Channel Islands are associated with sort of dodgy dealings. And she mentioned the possibility of a plot with some kind of money or conspiracy or crime behind it, which I'm thinking could be true. So art forgery, antiquity smuggling, mm-hmm. some kind of criminal dealings that end up with a dead guy.
Yeah,
that would be fun. I've mm-hmm. heard that Sark is a bit of a tax haven, so that could be interesting.
Yeah, I've heard that there's some smuggling that goes on there still.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, I would love that because it's very heisty, and you know, we all love a heist. Mm-hmm.
We love a heist. I also predicted ages ago that Murphy was actually smuggling stuff when he was visiting his supposed sister in Spain.
Supposed.
Why would he want Robin to go with him?
It was a double bluff. He knew that she wouldn't.
Sure. Okay.
There are also possibilities when it comes to the theme of fake versus authentic. Murphy versus Strike, right?
Mm-hmm. Oh, yes.
One is a fake love. One is a real love.
Yes, ma'am.
Love. Strike is the hallmarked man. He's got the stamp. Murphy does not have the stamp.
Well, like we said, he's got that secret tattoo.
Yeah. Triple A.
I already think that that's something that is going to happen in this book. So yeah. I'm here yeah. for it.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's the implications with the metal, because yeah. the final epigraphs of both Troubled Blood and The Running Grave referenced metals in regard to Strike and Robin's relationship, right?
Oh, you have to remind us what they are.
Yes.
Gladly, Lindsay, gladly. So Troubled Blood, it's a long epigraph. We'll only read the last two lines.
Mm-hmm.
So love of soul doth love of body pass. No less than perfect gold surmounts the meanest brass. Gold.
Yeah.
And then in The Running Grave, but when two people are at one in their inmost hearts, they shatter even the strength of iron or of bronze. Oh, so no okay. silver yet, but it's yeah. on theme, right?
Mm-hmm. Oh, hello, Emotions Closet. We meet so soon in the episode.
Right?
I know.
Hey, speaking of metal,
yeah.
can I change one letter of that word for a second and talk about a medal?
Ooh.
Yes.
Because this feels like an appropriate theme to tie Strike's medal in with, right?
Mm-hmm.
Do we
mm-hmm.
know what that would have been made of?
Well, like a kind of metal.
Some kind of metal, yeah.
Some kind of metal. Well, we don't know which metal it was, although I've had some guesses in the past.
Mm-hmm.
I feel like a medal could absolutely make Strike hallmarked. Like, that's his hallmark, because it's a mark of his quality, right? If it's for something heroic he did.
I would definitely say he's a quality man. Yes.
I feel like it could count as an Ink Black Heart parallel, just as far as learning stuff about Strike.
Yeah.
Haven't known that we wanted to know for a long time.
In yeah. six, we learned about the Latin mm-hmm. and the school. And then
yep.
in eight, we learned about the medal.
Yeah.
Oh, fingers crossed.
Fingers crossed.
I want so it long. So bad.
But that could be his hallmark.
I really like that.
Another possible meaning, going back to what you said earlier, Lindsay, about hallmark bringing to mind cheesy movies,
yes.
is romance. Is Strike hallmarked up trying to woo Robin?
That's the interpretation I like.
I like that interpretation. And you know, in Troubled Blood, he thinks about how he wants to be free from demands to service Hallmark's idea of romance.
Mm.
And so now we might be out here in book eight being like, well, how the turntables.
Mm-hmm.
I very much want to see Strike's idea of romance.
Oh, God, yes. Big same. I'm not going to suggest that maybe they're in Sark and Strike this time gives in to the impulse to buy Robin a present, pops into a local jewelry shop with owners named Tonks who are really nice to Joe, but I'm not suggesting it.
Right. I'm all about Strike buying gifts because you know we love that.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm all about advertisements in books for people who've been nice to Joe.
Yeah.
Like the pasta in Burning mm-hmm. Grave was amazing. I want that for the jewelry shop. One more thing I was thinking of
yeah.
was the timing of this announcement, because we got the title on March 15th, the Ides of March, famously the date that Caesar was assassinated in the Roman Senate, being stabbed 23 times. What if this is a hint to some kind of betrayal or assassination in the, like, we should all stab Caesar sense, being behind the murder? And supporting this is the fact that Caesar was mentioned in The Running Grave. Robin and Murphy are supposed to go see Hail Caesar, but they don't because they have a fight.
Does it mean that Murphy's getting stabbed?
I mean, I would not want to see it.
Oh boy, that would be traumatic.
After, like, he has to get stabbed after Robin breaks up with him, because I don't want her staying with him out of guilt that he's been stabbed.
Like Matthew?
Exactly. Yes. And now that I've said that,
I don't think he's getting stabbed. Let's move on.
Okay, great. I was going to spiral, but
I know, good. I could see it happening.
So then after Joe announced the title, when she was still tweeting with people, we got a couple more tidbits.
Oh, this is so exciting.
We know that it is going to be a few chapters.
Yes.
In which
it's not the whole
Sark
book.
Is featured. Not the whole book, a few chapters. And we found out from someone who talked to her on Sark that her characters, plural, are going to be there in February.
Yes. Let's talk about what we think this means.
Yes.
I know we don't actually know which characters are going. Mm-hmm. I feel safe guessing that this means Strike and Robin. Mm-hmm. It's what I've been thinking, especially given that she liked to tweet about the two of them going before.
I agree. I'm certain it's Strike and Robin now, considering these two pieces of information together. Mm-hmm. It's 100% Strike and Robin.
What are we thinking this means for the timeline of the book if they're there in February? So mm-hmm. we know that she mentioned Strike's 42nd birthday, which mm-hmm. is November 23rd, 2016. So I'm assuming, obviously, this is February of 2017.
Yeah.
Do you think that we're going to get a few initial chapters still in 2016 and jump into the new year, or are we living out the rest of 2016 and then into 2017 with them? What do you think?
I think that we're living out 2016 until 2017 with only a few minor time skips in between, or at least that's what I'm hoping, just because I'd like a slightly shorter time scale for some of these remaining books.
I agree. I don't think we're getting a big time jump. I think the trip to Sark will be in the second half of the book, maybe near the end, which bodes really well for those romantic moments that we were imagining, right? Also, February, Valentine's Day trip.
Oh, okay. Mm-hmm.
Just saying, it could coincide. And also, there's no way Murphy is still around in February. There's no
God,
way.
I hope not. Come on. Hold on, I need to pray.
Yeah.
Please, he's gonna be
you dumped. God. You dumped, Murphy. Yeah. There's no way that's sticking around for how many months? Five more months?
Please don't jinx it, Pools.
Not jinxing it.
I think the thing that's most interesting to me regarding the timeline is that Joe is visiting now. Because we know she said that she wanted to go around this time of year since they're there in February. But if it was towards the beginning of the book, she might have gone last year when she first started it, right?
Yeah.
Not that she can't go back and add things in, but it does lead me to believe that Sark might come after part six, since we know she's already done with that, mm-hmm. what she's working on now. I don't know. Maybe we're way off. That's what I'm thinking right now. Very interested to find out.
Me too.
Also, as a side note, I did go see about that bracelet. Did you guys all look this up too?
Mm-hmm. Oh, absolutely. I did. I didn't see it on the website, although I saw a bunch of other gorgeous pieces.
Joe shared it again this morning. Yeah. It's now available. Yeah.
Oh, nice.
It's like 90 pounds. And then if you convert that into US dollars, that's like 115. And then plus shipping, it's like almost $150 out the door.
Yeah. I wonder if that bracelet is just a thing that Joe got, or if, like you said about gifts, if something is going to come up in the book, if it's in the book, I will die.
If it's in the book, I'll buy that fucking bracelet, no matter how financially responsible it is.
Right. Same.
If he gives Robin a bracelet, I'm going to have that bracelet in my cart the second I finish that book. Come on.
I know.
All right. Can we touch on one more thing? So as far as the trademark stuff for this, because as soon as we figured out what the name of the book was, you know, I immediately was like running over to trademark stuff in the UK. And I found some interesting stuff.
Do share.
Joe filed this trademark on October 6th, 2023. So not that long after Running Grave came out. And then also, as far as when it actually was officially registered, it was March 8th.
Just last week?
Yeah.
Nice. Oh.
Which probably explains why she's okay with talking about it now.
Yeah.
But yeah, I thought that was really interesting, especially that she had registered it so soon after Running Grave came out.
Now, is it registered with a company that we've seen before? Kent?
It is not. The different company.
Ooh.
Very intriguing.
We're going to have to deep dive into this stuff, right? Mm-hmm.
See if there's anything interesting.
I don't think it worked out for us last time, but that's not going to stop us.
No. Never has, never will. Yep. Thank you for your service, Ken.
You're welcome.
You're supposed to say, and thank you for yours. You're never going to go pure spirit.
Come on, Ken. Go pure spirit.
We're never going to go pure spirit.
Okay, pardon me. And I for yours.
So what do we think this means for the release date? Is getting the title a sign that we are getting the book this year?
God, I hope so.
Well, fingers crossed.
Mm-hmm.
I'd still be okay with early 2025, though.
I'll be okay with literally whatever it is, because we have to be. There's only one time where we haven't gotten the book in the same year that she announced the title. Okay. I'm not really including Ink Black Heart because she announced the title December of 2021. So it's not like it's possible we would get it the same year. But you know what I mean? Yeah. The months following, within the year is a better way to say it. Right. The only time it was still over a year away was with Lethal White. But I don't feel like we can count Lethal White in with these kinds of things because that was the great wait, you know, the great 3-year wait.
Mm-hmm. Yes, that was the anomaly. I'm still trying to recover from that 3-year wait.
Traumatized.
I've seen things.
You've seen things.
Lived things.
You're like, okay, so if there are new fans, you're like the grandpa talking about how you walked 10 miles to school
in
the snow.
I did.
Uphill backwards.
You don't know what it was like.
You don't know what it was like.
After 2015, we waited 3 years.
3 years.
What about November or December? Is that a time of year that people...
I think so. Folks?
Christmas shopping.
Yeah. Also, the Robert Galbraith accounts saying to watch the space for more news, it makes me feel like it's possible that the date is coming soon.
Yeah.
That definitely felt like a thing.
Yeah. If we had to wait until next year, I don't think they would be like, hey.
We'll see. We know how the Robert Galbraith account can be, but it felt significant. And we also got a very, very brief mention from Joe about book eight. Oh, sorry, from not book eight.
I suddenly forgot it.
The Hallmark Man. Mm-hmm. Someone asked how it was going and she said getting there.
Oh my God.
Getting there. Don't know what that means.
I feel like that gif of Jennifer Lawrence that's doing that interview with Sean from Hot Ones and she's got this progressively more stricken look on her face where she's like, what does it mean? What does that even mean?
That's me literally every time Joe tweets something about the books. What does it mean?
What does it mean, Joe?
Okay. Should we go on to the next very exciting piece of news that we've already teased?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So we got a new header.
We did.
You know what? It's so nice because she does these things because people ask for them.
Yeah.
You know, and then she responds yes that she'll do it. So the emojis we got because Patricio asked. This one, the account A asked for a new header and she said yes and she gave us one. Pools, do you want to explain what this is? Because you're the one who found the source first, I think.
I did find the source.
Good job.
So the header is taken from the image of an antique silver Neff, which is a very detailed model of a ship that was designed to be a centerpiece on a dinner table, basically. They're usually made of silver or silvered metal or something precious like that. And they were used to store stuff like spices, condiments, napkins, flatware, sweetmeats. And they marked like the host place, or you wheel them around the table with their little wheels. They started off, they were big in the medieval period, but this one in particular is from 1923 and is made by the Pierpoint Brothers firm. And I found a few interesting things about them. So first, they were based in London, right around where the office is in Soho. And then second, and I'm quoting from some website I found about them, that said that Pierpoint copies of ancient patterns are dangerously near being indistinguishable from the originals, which could be a hint about a fraud or forgery plot. Or it could be a total coincidence and Joe just grabbed the first picture of a silver ship that she liked.
Mm, okay. All of that's very interesting. However, we have to talk about that this is a ship. Get it? It's a ship.
I do. I mean, combine that with the line, ship setting full sail out of the harbor that we got in the last chapter of The Running Grave. I think that Joe's teasing us with this.
Oh my God. I didn't even realize that we got that line.
Yeah.
No.
Well, our ship is set like sail. Not talking about clients in front of Pat or something. Ship was setting sail out of the harbor.
Yeah.
Right?
I didn't realize. That's hilarious.
It's amazing.
Aww.
Right? I know. So putting this all together, I think that like silver art or artifacts might be important to the plot somehow. Might be forgeries. Something might be stolen. Something might be smuggled. Who knows?
I wonder if this item in particular is in the book or if it's just a general silver ship connecting to the plot somehow.
Yeah.
I wouldn't be surprised if we read about this exact same item in someone's house. Like they go to interview someone and it's there. There were a couple of things like that in Troubled Blood. So Irene had that Margot Fonteyn figure.
Yes.
That you can look up online. And Janice had that Cinderella carriage. And I'm pretty sure that I found the right one online. Mm-hmm. And there's a picture of that, the one that I found on the Strike Fans page for Janice's location where she lives.
Yeah.
So it would be interesting.
Mm-hmm. It
be very interesting.
I'm also just wanting to go on a tangent about silver. Mm-hmm, you know, what metal. Silver represents in general.
Yeah.
Chemical properties. Mm-hmm. I looked it up just a bit. Among metals, it's the most reflective and the best conductor of electricity and heat, which...
Ooh, yeah. Electric shocks.
Electric shocks. You know what I'm going with that.
I know where you're going with that. I mean, that's an interesting rabbit hole because we know that Joe likes literary alchemy because of the Solvit Coagula tattoo. Silver in alchemy is one of the planetary metals, which is connected to the moon and Mondays and the brain. So that's a thing.
Moon Mondays and the brain.
You know what else pops up when I think of silver is 30 pieces of silver signifying betrayal.
Oh.
Like Judas, right? Okay. And that would fit with my...
Somebody's betrayed and killed.
Ides of March. Let's all stab Caesar. Ooh, yeah.
That's interesting.
Mm-hmm.
I like that.
And then...
There's a lot of places we can go with this.
Silver bullets. Someone has to kill a werewolf.
Is somebody a vampire?
Oh my God.
Silver bullets are for werewolves, Lindsay. And you know that.
I don't actually, apparently.
Garlic and steaks are for vampires.
Okay, I'm so sorry.
You don't know this.
Gotta get your lore right.
God damn it, Lindsay. You're supposed to be a professional.
Professional what?
A vampire hunter? I don't know what you do in your spare time. Silver bullets are for werewolves.
Okay.
I'm pretty sure.
I'm sorry, Twilight didn't teach me this.
Yeah, well, Twilight taught us a lot of things.
What did Twilight teach you?
How to chew through a womb.
Yes.
To evict a
baby. In case you ever need to
vampire
do that.
Baby.
Valuable life skills right there.
Valuable life skills.
Although I would really love sparkly skin. Let me be honest.
Yeah. Anyway, so I think that we have comprehensively covered all of the news we got. It was an insane 24 hours. Just insane.
Yeah. I cannot wait to get the synopsis and see
how wrong we were.
If we're, well, yes, we'll probably be wrong, but I don't know. I'm really loving my idea of an unidentified victim, I gotta say.
Mm-hmm. That would be really fun.
I don't know. It's just so much fun when you get the synopsis and then we can try and fit some of these pieces in a little bit more.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. So much fun.
So much.
Can't wait.
This is one of my favorite things about just being part of the fandom and waiting for these books to come out is this part of it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Starting to get all of the clues and it feeling like it's really ramping up. Mm-hmm. So exciting. It's so much fun to do it with everybody. Mm-hmm. All right. Is there anything else that we got to cover before we start?
There is just one small little bit of extra news regarding the Ink Black Heart adaptation. And it's about that guy, Dan Cade, that we were talking about, that we were speculating could be Murphy. Mm-hmm. We got a confirmation that he is playing a character called Carisford.
Hmm. Not Murphy.
Not Murphy.
Interesting, because this is obviously a name change or an added character. Mm-hmm. I still think a member of the Havening is a good guess, especially given this guy's martial arts background.
Yeah, that seems likely.
I'm leaning that way too.
If we have a slow news week, we'll have to dive deeper into all of this.
Mm-hmm. How much more deep can we dive? We've divin so deep.
We've divin?
We've divin so deep.
I feel like we could do it. I think we can divin. I like that word.
Thank you.
Should we get into the Q&A?
Yes.
The Q&A for this episode is, what inspired you to explore the theme of religious cults in The Running Grave?
I've always been very, very interested in mind control. I've always been very interested in groupthink and therefore in cults. So it's something I always wanted to explore somehow in a book. So as I say, in 2010, when I started really thinking about how the whole series would take shape, I did foreshadow this because I thought this is going to be the time when I get to explore those things that interest me so much. And I love world building and creating this cult, really thinking about what kind of cult I believe would take fire now in, you know, as we're a couple of decades into the 21st century. What would it take to hook people in, perhaps particularly young people? But as we see in the book, it's not only young people who are attracted to this cult, but successful cults really manage to hook onto something in the zeitgeist. They understand what people want to hear, what people are trying to escape. And I think that the Universal Humanitarian Church does that very effectively within the book. So my jumping off point for the cult were the words that the cult leader says the very first time that Robin enters one of their meetings in their temple. And the words are, I admit the possibility. the possibility that there is a deity, the possibility that there is life beyond the earthly plane. I think that's a good way of hooking people who may consider themselves atheists or skeptics. None of us can say for sure there is nothing beyond, but by saying I admit the possibility, the cult leader cleverly opens that door 1 inch and people want to come back. So that for me was the sort of ground zero for this cult. Do you admit the possibility?
The first thing that hits me is the idea of admitting the possibility, because this is clearly another big theme of this book. What I'm really interested in is how this theme presents itself in both negative and positive ways, and also that the concept itself isn't bad, but in the hands of the wrong people, it can be. It kind of reminds me of that argument between Hermione and Xenophilius Lovegood in chapter 21 of Deathly Hallows. Hermione says, "I mean, you can claim that anything's real if the only basis for believing in it is that nobody's proved it doesn't exist." "Yes, you could," said Xenophilius. "I'm glad to see that you're opening your mind a little." So this example is really interesting to me because you have two good people who just see the world very differently. And in this case, Hermione was wrong. But also in this example, this concept can be good. It can be about discovery, exploration, maybe even belief or faith. But in The Running Grave, we see it being used by the UHC to manipulate vulnerable people and trap them into this groupthink. It's the opposite of discovery and exploration. Mm. But at the same time, we have this whole other positive side of this happening when we see Strike admit the possibility that love is worth the risk, right? It's so great because when Strike goes to see Jonathan Wayse speak, he crosses his arms and he refuses to say he admits the possibility, but he does admit possibilities in this book.
He does.
Oh, it makes me think of that line in the Lethal White prologue. Strike was forced to recognize how long and how deeply he had hoped that Robin would not marry. He had wanted her free to be what they had been together, free so that if circumstances changed, so the possibility was there, free so that one day they might find out what else they could be to each other.
Oh,
oh my God, and they're gonna.
Oh, God. Oh, Lindsay. Oh, no. You can't just.
But see, the possibility is in there, the word.
Oh my God, you can't just bring up quotes like that out of nowhere. My heart. Oh my God. Okay, if y'all don't mind me going down memory lane here for just a second. Uh-huh. I remember the first time that I read that. I was listening to the audiobook late at night after work while I was having a bubble bath. And I swear to you. Like 2 o'clock in the morning when this part came on, I legitimately almost squeaked out loud.
Yeah, I get it.
Because that was the first time that I think it ever really clicked for me that Joe wasn't just teasing the relationship stuff, but actually planning something out that was really going to pan out. It was so exciting.
Very.
But moving off of that, though, I really love the connection that you've made here between the ideas of admitting the possibility that Jonathan Wayse talks about and the possibilities that Strike admits to himself in this book. Mm-hmm. It's just the way that Joe weaves aspects of the case throughout the personal subplots in these books is so skillfully done and satisfying to mm-hmm. read. I don't know if I've mentioned it. I really like these books a lot.
Not yet today, but it's always a good time to say it.
Always.
I'm also really fascinated by her thoughts on what a 21st century cult would need to take off. You know, when you think about the things that the UHC presents, all the videos they show, it's not that these things aren't upsetting or wrong. I think mm-hmm. that she's criticizing the idea that there's only one solution to these things, you know, only one way to think. And if you don't, then you are the adversary like the UHC presents. Mm-hmm. I just hope no one reads this and gets any ideas on how to start a cult. To be successful.
No. Please, nobody make a UHC 2.0. Please.
Someone comes at me with a little girl from The Ring. I'm running.
Yep, run fast.
If I see a tracksuit, I'm going the other way. Mm-hmm. Okay, we ready for chapter 67?
Yes. In chapter 67, Strike looks into Charlotte's funeral and speaks with Jacob Messenger. And in the epigraph, it says, "It is not I who seek the young fool. The young fool seeks me." And that is from hexagram 4, Youthful Folly.
This is the same hexagram that was for the Heatons. Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's kind of funny. There are a lot of people seeking Strike in this chapter. There's the woman who works for Patterson, who's spotted outside the office. Jacob Messenger calls, and so does Amelia. Mm-hmm. I think that you can argue that these attempts are all foolish. Whatever Patterson is up to is definitely foolish. Jacob Messenger's attempt to get Strike to do a reality show is also very foolish and hilarious. And then there's Amelia. I wouldn't call her a fool, but I think we know from the epilogue that she came to the conclusion to destroy the note and not show it to Strike on this trip that she's about to go on. So this attempt at contacting him here was probably still done with the intention to show him the note. So arguably a foolish choice.
Yeah, I think it is. I think this is a good interpretation. There are lots of foolish attempts to seek him out. The actual context of the hexagram doesn't really help here. I think it's about the proper way for a student to seek out a teacher. So mm-hmm. I think that this is just the literal interpretation of the lines.
Yeah.
And if we're interpreting this really literally, I think this does apply most to Jacob because he is a fool.
Yeah.
And it's not the Jacob that Strike is looking for, but he is very interested in seeking out Strike for his own foolish purposes, right?
Yeah.
So we open the chapter with Strike on an overnight surveillance on the Franks, and he's rereading Robin's letter.
I like that he takes her letter with him. Mm-hmm. It says it's because there are things that interest him, but we all know he's already read it and knows what's in there. I feel like he's not fooling me.
Mm-hmm. Right.
With this.
Cormoran Strike, master of subtlety and man who is definitely not intentionally carrying a piece of his partner around with him because he misses her.
Does he fold it up and stick it in the pocket closest to his heart? Because like in my imagination, he does. He absolutely just wants to stare at her handwriting for a while.
The first thing from Robin's letter is that Juan has been moved. Where do you think they moved her to? Possibly Dr. Zhu's place in London with the enemas?
Oh, that seems likely. Hopefully no green tea or other random fluid enemas.
Mm.
But one thing that we know about those liquids, though, they won't be important.
I mean, you don't know that. Like, maybe they're more important than we think. Maybe Zhao has actually discovered the cure for some kind of intestinal disease, and we're all writing it off because he's an unqualified quack doctor in the upper echelons of an evil cult.
Somehow, I doubt it.
All I'm saying is that even broken clocks are right twice a day. And sometimes green tea enemas turn out to be the most important liquids of them all.
Oh my goodness. How did we go from the literary significance of water and renewal to green tea enemas being the important liquids?
I mean, when you think about it, in a loose sense, is the green tea enema not just a baptism of the bowel?
Oh my God.
Am I wrong? No.
Christ almighty.
You probably shouldn't use the word loose and bowel in the same sentence.
Oh my God.
Although probably accurate for what happens after one of those treatments.
Oh my God. I never thought I would live to see the day when Pools engages in body humor. Amazing.
It's still inside the body, not outside the body. So it's...
We're wonderful.
Somehow in my mind it's different. Yeah. It's medical when it's inside the body and it's gross outside the body. There's a line in my mind, which is really weird, I know.
It is. Yeah, okay. makes no sense.
Yeah, I know.
The baptism of the bowel.
In seriousness, though, they might have moved her to Zhao's clinic, but I don't think they'd keep her there that long after she recovered. I'm betting she's now at another center. Just to make sure she's nowhere near the baby, they're not bringing her back to the farm, right? Because if she's off the farm, makes it easier for Mazu to live out her creepy little real Chinese baby fantasy.
Yeah.
I cannot find a way to phrase that. It doesn't make it sound really gross and racist and appropriative because it is. So there's no better way to phrase that. That's what it is.
So we also learned that Mazu has named the baby girl Yixin and is carrying her around like she is the biological mother rather than Juan.
Oh boy.
Oh boy, indeed.
Oh boy.
She doesn't do this with all the babies, right? The fact that she still has this baby with her when Robin confronts her in the temple at the end, it implies to me that Mazu wanted to keep this baby as her own, right?
Oh yeah.
Yeah.
I don't think this baby was getting sent off to be sold.
No. No, definitely not. I'm not sure if she does this with all the babies, though I wouldn't be surprised if she did, if she just did it to kind of play into that whole Mama Mazu thing.
Yeah, she's 100% keeping this baby, specifically because pretending that it's her baby plays into her whole I'm actually Chinese delusional cultural ethnic appropriation fetish that she has going on. And I'm like, my God. Like, okay, Rachel Dolezal.
She is Rachel Dolezal, but yeah, worse,
so much worse. Mazu's on the road to get herself canceled right now.
Ooh, yeah.
Gotta say, kind of deserves it.
Do we ever find out what parameters they use to determine what babies get shipped off to Birmingham and which ones stay for the classes and whatnot that we get to see?
I think it's established eventually that they mostly keep the babies that are fathered by Wace or Tayo, like his bloodline, basically. Mm-hmm. And then also enough unrelated girls so that the next generation isn't hopelessly inbred. Which actually, though, probably works really well for them because I'm guessing that baby boys are worth more on the market. Mm-hmm. I hate this earth and I want to get off of it. Summon down the spaceships because I'm out. Mm. Is that a different cult?
Yes.
Who do I talk to get a space on the spaceship cult off the
earth? You're in luck because they're still around. I mean,
thank God.
I mean, the ones who are still around are around because yikes.
They didn't.
Yeah. Gotcha. I'm sure you can contact them on their website.
I'll look it up because I'm going to need a ride off of this hellhole.
And Robin does think in the next chapter that the baby could be Wace's. So maybe is it normal for them to take care of them as babies?
I don't really see Mezu taking a huge hands-on role in infant care most of the time.
Right.
For some reason.
Maybe she'd
terrify and traumatize the babies just with her face. I think it's just this baby in particular she wants to get her little hands on.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I would not want Mezu as my nanny.
No. The fact that the baby is always described as crying from another room, I feel like she just leaves her there to cry.
Yeah. I don't think she's taking very good care of the baby.
I'm not a huge fan of the cry it out. So
I'm not either. My dad insisted on that for me. And look at how I grew up. Traumatized as hell. Very obviously fucked up from that whole thing. So
next, Strike is also really interested in Emily's opinion that Dayu didn't drown.
This whole bit is some really wonderful misdirection because, of course, the truth is that she didn't drown, but we all fell for the reason that Strike was thinking that if she didn't drown, she must be alive, when the truth is that she never even made it to the beach.
And the motivation that Strike's thinking about, that £250,000, is also incredibly convincing given what we've seen of the Wases so far.
Oh, yeah.
We know that there's no way they'd let go of their chance at so much cash. And it is, to me, at this point in the book, it's completely plausible that they go to pretty much any length to keep it. So I was fully on board with his theory here.
Yeah, me too.
Lastly, Strike had told Robin about the woman who had previously followed him and asked if there's any chance that she has to do with the UHC. And Robin says, I don't know whether that woman you mentioned has got anything to do with the church, but I don't think anyone here knows or suspects who I really am.
What did you both think of this? Because I raised my eyebrows a little bit. She's technically right, but considering the two big ways in which she's been compromised recently, I felt like she should have been a little more concerned about this.
Yeah. I definitely raised my eyebrows a bit at this too, because not even touching on the Farrah stuff, it's not like she's not compromised. But by the same token, I feel like it's kind of like with Strike with the Charlotte stuff from last episode. She knows that telling him is just going to worry him, make him want her to come out. And she's not at a point where she feels okay leaving. So
yeah, well, it's a little bit different from Charlotte because that's a personal thing. This is definitely case related and directly related to her safety. But I do agree, if she would have told him, it would have been a thing. Mm-hmm. I'm just saying, I wasn't so sure at this point that no one knew or suspected her. So this made me nervous.
I think that Robin's reasoning is probably that if the cult knew who she was, or were suspicious enough of her identity to have Strike followed, then she would have already been whatever it is she thinks they'd do to her. Like, put her in the box, lock her up, kill her, interrogate her, pick your poison. I think she reasons that there's no way they'd be letting her just continue on at the farm like she is if they knew or suspected that she was a detective.
Yeah, it's not a good coincidence when Tayo's, giving her these unfriendly looks, and with everything that's happened, it just really ups the anxiety for me at this point. Yeah,
it's not a pleasant coincidence.
And then we get these few paragraphs about the Franks, and what they're doing is so disturbing. Ugh. A storage unit full of food and water. They were planning on keeping Tasha alive and hostage for a long time.
Mm-hmm. Creepy fucks. They are indeed.
Yes.
I feel like the inclusion of these little details really adds a little certain extra je ne sais quoi to the Franks plot.
For me, it definitely added to the fear of what was going to happen to Robin. If our theory that the side cases connect to the main case is correct, I was afraid of kidnapping either while Robin was still in the cult and she wouldn't be allowed to leave, or it happening afterwards if they recaptured her. The tension with the Franks intensified my worries over the UHC.
Yeah, I was terrified for the entire back half of this novel that the UHC mm-hmm. was going to kidnap Robin or Will or both yeah. of them off the street. It would have been so easy just to drag them into a van, right?
I know.
Every time Robin mentions being outside, I was just biting my nails.
Especially because that's how
Alexander Graves
yeah. was kidnapped, but the opposite way.
Yes, so the UHC is going to do that to them.
Yeah,
I was scared. Bet that subconsciously this whole Frank's plot was the reason why, because she planted mm-hmm. that possibility in my brain.
Yeah, right? We admitted the possibility to ourselves, didn't we?
I did. I let the possibility in. I gave it a drink. I told it to stay as long as it wanted. I set up the sofa bed for it. Mm-hmm. It was resident.
It was staying over.
Staying the night. Yeah. Only one bed.
I was so tempted yesterday to respond to Joe and ask, so they stay there, but there? Is there one bed?
I need how many beds, to know Joe? How many beds?
I did it, though. I controlled myself.
And next, Strike Googles Charlotte's funeral.
Oh, Macy hadn't done this yet. You know Robin will be Googling that right when she gets home.
You know Ilse's already Googled it and has mentally prepared the report that she's going to give Robin about it once she's at the UHC, right?
Mentally, I'm sure she has screenshots to show her.
She's got her PowerPoint ready yeah. of all of the Strike nonsense she's had to put up with since Robin has been in this cult. She's like, never leave again. I can't deal with this myself.
I still think Robin probably would have Googled it on her own, though.
Yeah.
She'll want to see, you know, Madeline and Kiara first. And raise her eyebrows a bit.
Oh, absolutely. Also, though, considering the fact that the funeral, it says, was earlier that day, Strike didn't really last that long before Googling it.
Yeah, he tried.
So we're given some detail about how exactly Charlotte died.
It's awful. I feel horrible that Strike can't shake the image. It has to be unpleasant, to say the least.
It does. The perils of having a vivid imagination.
Or intrusive thoughts.
Or worse yet, both.
Yeah. As we talked about last time, there might be some sort of significance to her dying in water with no baptism. Just this image is hard to think about without thinking about that as well.
Yeah, it made me think suddenly of the concept of baptism by blood. It's the idea that you can achieve grace through martyrdom without needing to be baptized by water. So I suppose, following this rabbit hole, in a sense, Charlotte has been killed by her adherence to her faith. It's her faith in her own darkness and pain. Because as Strike says later, she made a cult out of her unhappiness.
Yeah.
She places the blame for her death on everyone else, primarily Strike. And it seems to me she might see herself as kind of a martyr. She could be figured as a martyr to this
love,
her own cult, to her love, to whatever. But Charlotte doesn't achieve grace. I think that the image of the clotted surface, which is very gross, of the blood is. Water, yeah. shows that there's no rebirth, renewal, no grace happening here.
We have blood and we have water.
Two very important liquids. One very gross tub.
Yeah.
I don't know if that makes any sense, like, as a concept, but that's just what I was sort of thinking.
I like that.
Like, she's the martyr. She's baptized in the blood, but false. It's false god.
Yeah, there's a lot of death in water. So we have Dai's alleged drowning, Jennifer Waste, Deirdre, Robin almost dying in water. Mm-hmm. And then you have the symbolic dying in water with baptism, death of the old self.
You know, I was thinking about this, mm-hmm. and it seemed to me in the moment that the ritual aspect of baptism, like the actual submersion in water, is pretty much exclusively linked to death and tragedy and malice in this book, except for the opening scene with Benji. But even then, mm-hmm. it's a baby. The baby doesn't know to renounce Satan.
Right.
The true rebirth of this book, Strikes, it might be linked to the symbols of the church, but it takes place within himself in full self-consciousness and responsibility, right? Right? I don't know. It's hinting towards where real truth can be found and not found. It's like getting attached to the symbols of the thing. It's not the thing itself. Maybe the liquids aren't actually that important after all. The important liquid was in our heart the whole time. That went full circle and I got lost in it.
So. No, I mean, the funny thing is that you're describing exactly what I think is important for baptism in the first place. It has Great. Nothing to do with any of that. I don't care sure. if someone's baptized, where they're baptized, what they're baptized with.
It's about
the inside and the heart anyway. So that works
maybe
for
me. Maybe that's the point the whole time.
It's been the point the whole time.
Strike learns that Charlotte was buried in Brompton Cemetery, calling it one of the smartest in the capital. And he thinks that Charlotte's mother chose it specifically for the publicity.
Even mm-hmm. with death, these people are awful.
I was looking into Brompton Cemetery, and mm-hmm. to be fair, it does look very smart. It's one of the Magnificent Seven cemeteries, which is the group of the large private 19th century cemeteries that includes Highgate. Interesting fact,
Emmeline Pankhurst and Jon Snow are buried there, which is pretty interesting.
From Game of Thrones?
No.
Just kidding. I'm kidding.
Oh, okay. And this might be a bit of a stretch with parallels, but Emmeline Pankhurst was name dropped in Cuckoo's Calling. And another suffragist, Emily Davison, was mentioned in Lethal White, so like 147 sort of, but okay, probably not really.
It is a pretty good stretch.
Even I will acknowledge that that's a reach.
That takes a lot.
Yeah.
It is a very nice cemetery though. I looked it up too. Very different vibe from Highgate.
Very different. Not like overgrown, not romantic, just like very richy rich.
I did prefer Highgate if I had to choose.
Samesies.
Also, it kind of made me laugh reading the list of people at this funeral. Yeah. It reminded me of when we talked about who we'd invite to a dinner party or wedding seat charts or something.
Yeah.
You know, just really awkward for Strike with a couple exes.
I'm horrible, but it would have been so funny having Strike caught between multiple women that he slept with.
Which is two.
Well, and the dead woman.
Dead woman.
Okay. And then also, on the other hand, a bunch of rich ex-in-laws who loathe him. And then Jago Ross with all the shit that's going on there. Like, it would have been hilarious. At least Izzy would have been happy to see him.
Yeah, she definitely would. I think Madeline and Kiara would have been funnier, entertaining. Not so much with Jago.
No, I'm thinking not. That would not have gone well at all. All of a sudden, I'm hearing Ludacris in the background. You know, oh no, a fight's out. Put the punch up. Lights out.
I have no idea what you're referencing, but I'm sure it means something.
I don't either, but yes.
I know this is an irrational thought, but my first reaction to finding out that Strike hadn't been invited to the funeral was to be offended on his behalf. Not that I wanted him to go, but still, not even an invite. It's rude.
Rude.
Right? You spend close to half your life being either tied with or associated with somebody, and you can't even get an invite to their funeral.
I mean, he is literally the whole reason why they're there. And he can't get an invite.
Right?
Oh my God.
Sorry. Just kidding.
If they blame him for not stopping her, then I guess it kind of makes sense, but still. Rude.
Yeah, my brain does not want to fathom a world in which they actually believe it was his fault or believe the things that Charlotte said about him, because they too have experience with Charlotte and probably have also had her throw out false accusations about them or make up lies. But I know sometimes families will ignore facts like that. So
I really like this mention of Strike not being bothered by not being invited to the funeral, though. It says, as far as he was concerned, he'd said his farewells in the small Norfolk church overlooking Chapman Farm.
I did too. Even though I was offended on his behalf, I'm glad that he didn't feel that way. It is another sign of just how much he's moved on and how much he let all of that go in the church.
We also get another mention of Amelia here with the reminder that she'd called the office and that there had been a note.
Yeah, we can talk about it more when we get to the end, obviously, but I like to think that Amelia is a little more sensible than some of the other family members. It just seemed that way to me. It seemed like she understood that Charlotte's versions of things might not have been true. That's the impression I got from her. Mm-hmm. I like this bit where Strike thinks that he's happy to remain in ignorance of what the note said, especially when you think about the end, because he's not actually ever in ignorance of what it said, is he? He never sees it. He just knows. Maybe at this point, though, he's not really ready to think about it.
Yeah, I think that you're probably right. I feel like he probably doesn't let himself linger on it until he meets up with Amelia later.
And by the way, if you're looking for parallels to Cuckoo's Calling, Robin Googled pictures from Lula's funeral too. So this whole thing kind of feels familiar, right? And Kiara was at both of those funerals.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
both attended by famous people or well-known people. Both have a lot of publicity.
I think it counts.
Counts.
So the next big thing that happens is Strike sees an article about Humboldt's divorce featuring a photo of Bijou.
You know what's interesting? In this picture, Bijou is wearing a peacock blue dress, and it immediately makes me think of Charlotte's peacock blue wrap dress that had been Strike's favorite. Mm-hmm. I don't know what it means or how it connects to the other significance of blue, but it's certainly not a good comparison character-wise for Bijou.
Nope. Mm-hmm.
Maybe the connection is that both women either cause his name to be in the press or threaten to do it. There is definitely a Charlotte-level amount of bad behavior from Bijou, though.
Yeah, I noticed this too. I think you could definitely be onto something here. For me, peacock is associated with showiness, fanciness, flashiness, you know, like the albino peacock strutting around Malfoy Manor.
The peacocks would really appreciate it if you didn't describe it as strutting every time they walked around.
My apologies to peacocks everywhere. But both women going to the press is drawing attention, right? Attention he does not want. This could also be a sort of reminder of us that Strike has moved on from Charlotte, because the dress was his favorite, but now we're seeing it again on a woman he actively dislikes who's causing him problems. I mean, he kind of also caused himself some problems here, but you know.
She caused a lot of problems.
The dress connection is emphasizing how much the scales have fallen from his eyes in regards to the reality of his relationship with Charlotte. These two are paired together now.
Mm-hmm.
Also, we're going to see the real love of his life wearing blue soon too. A blue tracksuit when she escapes and he rescues her.
It reminds me a bit more, though, of Robin wearing the blue shirt in Whitstable, maybe even her blue dress.
Yes.
The peacock blue is the wrong blue, now overshadowed by his true love in true blue.
True blue.
Dev shows up with photos of the unknown woman who isn't a stalker, but kind of feels like one. There are so many people watching The Office in this book.
Yeah, there really are. It's a good thing that they have extra security at the office now.
The
yeah.
extra locks.
The locks.
Yeah. Strike thinks that if she's a Patterson spy, she might be trying to find out who works there and get dirt on them. But this bit cracked me up when Dev said he'd hold off on starting that heroin habit then.
It's so funny. And we haven't seen many jokes from Dev. That was
good. I know. It was good. Mm-hmm. I like Dev.
My question is, though, so this woman is literally here to watch The Office, okay? But she doesn't notice Dev come out of The Office and then start taking pictures of her. She didn't try to hide her face or walk away. She's just there straight up chilling while he does this.
I'm sorry. You're totally reminding me of a line from Clue where Mrs. White, her husband disappeared. And then she says, but that was his job. He was an illusionist, but he never reappeared. He wasn't a very good illusionist. And I just, she's not a very good PI.
She's not a very good PI, no.
She probably got bored and was just looking at her phone.
Gotta say, I am not impressed at the quality of people working for Patterson.
Well,
yeah. And in my head, I still kind of think that Morris went to work for him and we just didn't get to hear about it because it was already a crowded book.
Yeah, I don't know. If he comes back, I feel like we'll know. Hopefully we'll see a little less of him, though, if you know what I mean.
Yeah, I get the implication there.
When Strike gets back to the office, Pat tells him that in addition to Amelia calling, he also got a call from Jacob Messenger.
Yeah, none of this is really significant, except that it rules this guy out as the Jacob at the farm.
Yeah.
It is hilarious, though, that he tried to pitch a reality show to Strike.
Oh, my God. Yes.
For the record, though, I would totally watch a show about a PI and their cases. That would actually be a really good show if there was someone, absolutely, you know, not worried about that. I would love that for real life.
Absolutely. Yeah, I'd watch the same thing. In this context, I immediately thought of the BBC show and then things like the cops episode of The X-Files, where the camera crews are following them with the werewolf, or the true crime documentary episodes of The Rookie, or that one episode of Castle or Leverage. I want the exact same vibe as those episodes. As a bonus, yeah, I know you don't know.
I literally don't know any of, yeah.
They're all great. I want as a bonus episode of the BBC Strike show, where the agency is stuck with a camera crew making a show or a documentary for some reason, and the tone is just incredibly comedic and hilarious. So I want Strike hiding from the cameras or just scowling silently at them when he can't escape. I want Barkley being hilarious in interviews, Robin trying to be professional but rapidly losing it at the camera crews, just all of Pat being Pat in interviews. I want Tasha showing up on surveillance to like work the cameras, but turns out she's doing it to distract them so that Midge can do the job. I want a joke where the camera guy is just constantly zooming in on Dev because he's just so good looking and Dev is like so annoyed that the camera is on him. And then a scene where Strike and Robin were hiding in the closet to make out to seem professional. Then the camera crews catch them and their relationship is exposed.
I think you're just thinking of that episode from The Office where they talk about, you know, the closet.
The closet. I am kind of thinking about the closet. It would be an absolutely hilarious episode of the show. And I know that they're just adapting the books, but could they not also do this?
I want outtakes.
I also want outtakes. And it's ridiculous that we don't have outtakes.
I really want to see if there are any actual documentaries about PIs, because that would be great.
There is apparently a documentary series that is about private investigators. You want me to tell you about it?
Yeah. What's it called?
It is called Secrets, Lies, and Private Eyes.
Ooh, rhyming.
Just pulled it up on IMDb. But it says this documentary series follows five different private investigators, some working in teams, some working alone, as they look into cases of infidelity, fraud, cold cases, fugitive retrieval, and more, mostly based in Tennessee.
Oh, that's awesome. Mm-hmm. I would totally. I'm going to look that up because I really would want to watch that. Fraud is kind of what we did mostly when I worked there. So that's interesting to me.
We haven't seen many fraud cases.
No, I've always kind of wanted her to do a side case that was kind of like the cases that we insurance would do fraud, yeah. just for funsies for me. Yeah, it was mostly insurance fraud. Like, oh no, I slipped and fell and now I can't walk, you know.
Here's me doing my 5K.
That would be a good one. Although that would be kind of an easy case to solve, right? It would just take a couple times to find the person, but.
It looks like they have a bunch of female PIs too.
Nice. I'm going to look that up.
Nice.
I love the ending of this chapter where Strike is contemplating the murder board.
Was it arrogant, he asked himself, to think he'd managed to trace a connection where nobody else had succeeded in doing so? Possibly. But then he'd been called arrogant before, most often by the woman who now lay freshly interred in Brompton Cemetery, and it had never yet deterred him from doing precisely what he'd set out to do.
I feel like it doesn't really count as arrogance if he's correct.
Yeah.
If he can back it up.
He's just confident in his BDE, his big detective energy, of course.
Hell yeah, he is.
Seriously, though, he is a good detective, and I feel like it's okay that he knows it.
And now I'm just thinking about that bit from 112 when he says, I don't need to ask myself whether I'm up to the job because I know I'm fucking great at it.
Ooh, yeah, you do.
That easy confidence.
Ooh, the church isn't the only thing he's burning to the ground with that. You know right? I mean.
Okay, let's go to chapter 68.
In chapter 68, Jonathan Wace visits Chapman Farm with some American recruits.
And the epigraph, 9 in the second place means the abyss is dangerous. One should strive to attain small things only. That's from hexagram 29, the abysmal water. I think the abyss in this case is referring to Chapman Farm itself. It's now becoming an even more dangerous place for Robin since she is now a little under suspicion after what happened with Emily. And striving to attain small things must refer to her list of things she wants to accomplish before she leaves.
I absolutely agree with that. She's having to walk a very, very fine, careful line right now.
Yeah. I really like the first line of the chapter when it says, a strange mood seemed to have infected Chapman Farm ever since members' tracksuits had changed to white. It just reminded me of how the UHC is compared to a cancer, and it's most apparent when it involves the Drowned Prophet.
You know, I was gonna be pedantic.
You?
About me?
Never.
No.
No. The condescending dickhead. Never.
No. No, Connie, you weren't.
I was going to be pedantic about cancer not being an infectious disease, but then I remembered that there are a bunch of bacterial and viral infections that cause cancer. And then I arrived at the thought that this basically means that Jonathan Wace is the HPV causing cancer in the cervix that is spirituality and faith.
In right? the cervix that is spirituality.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's Jonathan is the infection. And then obviously after that, I realized that my train of thought had just gone off the rails. But actually, I kind of think it tracks as a metaphor because you can address the initial infection, but the cancer that it caused remains and spreads.
You know?
Yeah. Right?
I think of all of the truly unhinged comparisons that you have made on this show, Pools, and Robin as hiking equipment. I'm looking
still
at you.
Still stand by that.
Jonathan Wace as human papillomavirus.
Yeah.
Is probably one of my favorites.
Yeah. Well, I mean, Jonathan Wace, genital warts feel like they're the same thing.
Yeah, they're pretty equivalent.
For the record.
Yeah.
I know that cancer isn't an infectious disease. Saying something reminds me of something else right? isn't saying it's the same thing.
Well, I mean, we've already established.
Okay, Connie.
My nickname. So.
You know what? That's actually really great. Every time this happens with Pools, I'm just going to say,
Connie.
Okay, Connie. Let's pull it back, Connie.
It's a good code word, actually. That works. I'm going to share that with my husband so he can do it too.
Let us know how that goes.
He'll like that. He'll be happy with that. Yeah. He might not live for very long after the first time he uses it. But.
It does also remind me about
yeah.
what you said, Pools, about cancer coming in threes. I don't know if there's any connection there. I'm just thinking about it.
Yeah, I don't know. I said that there was like one fake or manipulative, one deadly and one metaphorical cancer, right?
Yes.
In the Running Grave, it was Charlotte and it was the UHC. What was the third cancer?
Angel.
I forgot about that. Poor baby girl. Anyway, moving on. We've established Jonathan Wace's...
A horrifying venereal disease? Yes.
if that tracks. I'm just saying it tracks.
Anyway, Robin thinks about the change in the atmosphere, and it does such a good job of illustrating how strongly the belief in the Drowned Prophet has these people in its grasp, mm-hmm. and how unpleasant the manifestation is going to be. I think it's likely that the people who have been there a while understand that people are punished in the pool for this manifestation, right?
I think that you're right there. Anyone who's been around long enough to witness the manifestation of the Drowned Prophet, even once, is likely going to be scared shitless of being selected for it.
Exactly. It's like the Hunger Games. This is their reaping.
You know, the line where it says that cult members were even more performatively considerate, as though some hidden entity were constantly watching and judging. It's Dayu season. Of course, they're acting like the invisible surveillance has been stepped up, because Dayu is basically like the Panopticon Prophet. She's the one who watches them.
We get Robin thinking back to Norwich, and that while Tayo had initially bought her and Emily's story, she's now starting to think that he's suspecting her.
Is it just me? Or does this phrase here, at the mercy of the bubble people, really drive home how absolutely ridiculous this cult is? It seems to me like the mercy of the bubble people could be a terrible, low-budget episode of Doctor Who from the 70s, right? You know, Ken's knows what I'm talking about, where they've glued balls of plastic wrapped to some actors.
Absolutely horrendous.
Their suits with latex masks. And they've had them like chase an old white man and a cute girl in a mini skirt through a quarry in Wales. Like the bubble people, right?
Yep, it's 100%.
It honestly doesn't seem weirder than some of the real cult stuff I've seen recently. No way is bubble people weirder than Spirit Penis or Robin Williams talking to Mother God.
That will never not be hilarious.
There's just no way. Ridiculous. Bubble people seem so normal compared to those two things.
Yeah.
How did you all feel when it said that Robin caught Tayo looking at her in no friendly manner? Because this made me feel really nervous. But on the other hand, at least he's not looking at her in the other way he looks at her.
Yeah. I think I'll take annoyed looks over lecherous ones from Tayo any day. Definitely made me feel a bit anxious for her because it's like, oh.
No looks from Tayo are good. Robin also notices that a lot of people are giving her strange looks and appear to be talking about her. And she wonders if Vivian told anyone about her answering to her real name. What do you guys think? Do you think Vivian did or didn't?
You know, I think at the time when I was reading this, 100%. Because, I mean, she's brainwashed. She's paranoid. She's kind of mouthy. I could see her running around telling anybody who would listen that, you know, oh, Rowena responded to the name Robin. And isn't that a little bit weird? After all, we saw what happened whenever the other girl saw that mark on her arm from Lang. So,
See, I didn't think that she had yet, because later Will says that she was spreading it around like wildfire after Robin escaped, which to me implied that she wasn't before. Because maybe she didn't think it was significant until later.
Yeah, I think that that makes sense. I might be overestimating her intelligence and her nose for suspicious stuff.
Well, I wonder if she would have gotten in trouble for not saying anything. Ooh. Like, why didn't you tell us, you know?
Yeah, I'm kind of down for you're okay getting in trouble because she's fucking awful. I feel like she'd be an awful person outside the cult too. The cult didn't make her awful. She was already awful.
I can't tell you how excited and scared I was when I read for the first time that Robin knew she was on borrowed time at Chapman Farm. Mm. It was exciting because I knew it meant we were getting close, but I was scared because I knew bad things were coming up.
I think I was feeling anxious too, but at the same point, it was like, oh, thank fuck. We're finally reaching the end of the miserable cult stuff. She can get out.
I know.
Yeah.
So next, Robin thinks about the three things that she wants to do before she leaves. And the first of those things is to get as much information out of Emily as possible.
I felt like this was the one most likely to be accomplished at first, because we know Emily wants her to talk, right? It's going to be easy to make her talk. It's all about opportunity.
The next one is having a one-on-one conversation with Will.
That one seemed trickier, but for the opposite reason. More opportunity, less talkative.
And then lastly, she needed to look for the hatchet in the tree.
It's funny that ends up being the first
one. That's easy to do.
Yeah, that's the one that becomes easiest. But Robin does go into greater detail about why these three tasks will be difficult. But of course, she achieves all of them before she leaves.
Because she's exceptional.
She sure is.
That's our girl, yeah.
Now, the next big thing to happen is that Jonathan Wace is back at the farm with some American members.
You can tell they're American because they're all very attractive and have perfect teeth. Or did Wace just hire some starving actors in LA to pretend to be cult members in order to make it look good at the farm?
I'm thinking maybe not, but the thought is really funny. I guess it depends on how hard up they are for cash, you know?
Yeah.
Oh, Kenz, that was such a gentle letdown.
Yeah, Kenz is so nice to me. Unlike some people.
I have to say, technically, it was just the teeth that made her think American. Only the three women were described as beautiful. But I do tend to think that this was real, because we do know that there was a San Francisco center, and maybe somewhere else too.
You're right. You're right. The men are just described as preppy. Not necessarily good looking. You know, I'm not surprised that Wace is picking the women for their looks. That's on brand for him. But yeah, we do know that there is a San Francisco center. So these are probably definitely real members of this cult. Moving on, though, we get to the feast. And here's the thing. There are scarlet and gold banners in the dining hall, which means that Gryffindor won the house cup.
Congratulations, Gryffindor.
Hey, unfair point distribution at the last minute.
Congratulations, Neville.
Yay, good job, Neville. You earned it. Good job, Neville. You just made me remember how much I love Neville.
My favorite thing that Joe ever said about Neville was that he was the boy who proved he could have done it too.
Oh my God. Aww. Oh my God. Oh my God. Oh my God.
I love him so much. It's really touching, right?
He's such a baby. Okay. Anyway, so in addition to Gryffindor winning the house cup, they get real meat, which is good.
Yay. Very exciting.
I'm just really glad that Robin got a little protein boost because she's about to go through some shit.
And by the way, Americans, right? We're back to the American references here with these members. We also get a mention of Trump. It says that Jonathan Wace lambasted the campaign speeches of presidential candidate Donald Trump. The American visitors, Robin noticed, nodded vehemently as Wace painted a vivid picture of the fascist terror that would be unleashed should Trump win the election. I had half a mind to look at the timeline and try and figure out what speech Jonathan Wace was talking about. Ugh. I couldn't do it to myself, so I did it.
I'll take that for the team.
Oh, thank you, Pools.
So Wace arrives back at the farm on July 8th, 2016. So you'd think that he'd be talking about the speeches that Trump made in that month before the Republican National Convention, because that was at the end of July. So that's like a month from now that Trump is going to be the official candidate, nominee, whatever. So I was browsing through the comprehensive archive of his speeches and press releases. Honest to God, it mostly just looked like him attacking Hillary Clinton.
Yeah.
He also made a statement praising Brexit
for
asserting their independence. So it was, I think it was just pretty much business as usual for Trump. Nothing stood out to me.
I definitely think it's possible that we're going to get another mention of Trump in the next book, even if it's just brief as a major newsworthy event in 2016 or 17. British listeners, you'll have to tell us how much of that made your news. How are you feeling about the theory around all the American references now that we have this Sark location? Because it seems less likely to me that there would be any sort of American trip if we know that that's a place that they visit.
Yeah, that's what I'm thinking as well. Maybe in 9 or 10.
I mean, I was going to agree with you and say probably not. But putting on my tinfoil hat accessory here.
Okay.
The place that's selling that silver Neff ship that's in her new header, it's in Manhattan, New York City. Probably just a coincidence. Probably she just grabbed the first picture she liked. But still, I saw pizza and coffee in this book and I said New York City. So if that turns out to be true, I'm...
It could just be that someone bought it from there, right?
Yes. Also could be the case.
But that could still connect, right? If you have a connection to New York, maybe the victim is American.
Ooh, an American criminal.
Yeah.
It probably nonsense.
Right.
Because it was amongst the first results when you search for silver model ship.
Okay.
It was like third down. Probably not, but maybe.
The chapter ends with Amandeep getting acknowledged by Wace and another party happening where Robin ends up dancing with Kyle.
I rolled my eyes at Amandeep crying over this. I know other people have too, but I just can't handle it.
My dude.
I did feel so bad for Kyle, though, the way he's dancing and but silently chanting.
Yeah.
Oh, I hope he's okay when the farm is raided.
God, me too. Let's hope that he gets an excellent therapist and maybe a nice boyfriend.
Yes.
Or at the very least, a group of friends who can be a support system in the meantime.
I'm telling you, he and Flora can be friends.
They can just have UHC support group meetings.
There's going to be some UHC support groups going, and I feel like Flora would do really well at leading them.
Yeah, I think so. She's found the power that she's talking found the power. Gives her. She's
got the power, and I really loved Flora.
I do too. All right, should we go to chapter 69?
All right, chapter 69. Robin encounters Zhang while searching for the hatchet in the tree hollow.
The epigraph reads, "In dealing with persons as intractable and as difficult to influence as a pig or a fish, one must first rid oneself of all prejudice and, so to speak, let the psyche of the other person act." That's from Hexagram 61, Inner Truth.
I think this is all about how Robin deals with Zhang in this chapter. She does rid herself of prejudice and pretends to like and admire him, and she's able to manipulate him by saying all the things he wants to hear.
And this chapter is so important for what happens later, because it's this conversation that brings Zhang onto Robin's side just enough for her to later escape, right? The hexagram says after this bit that when a door has thus been opened, the force of one's personality will influence him, which it will. If in this way one finds no obstacles insurmountable, one can undertake even the most dangerous things, such as crossing the great water, and succeed. It's because of this influence Robin has that she can succeed at escaping through the window.
She crosses the great water of the sink.
Crosses the great water of the sink.
Yes.
Exactly. And books it out of there. And it's because Jiang gave her that little bit of, we had a bond. Yeah.
Yeah.
The chapter starts with Jonathan Wei showing up at breakfast to announce that Mazu has lost her mother of pearl fish pendant and that everyone will be looking for it.
Okay. I have some questions. One, it says that the pendant belonged to Dayu and that the fish was found in Dayu's bed on the morning of her ascension.
She was sucked off. She was taken up.
That's what it does sound like. For anyone wondering, we are referencing ghosts.
Ghosts, which is a very funny joke.
Very funny joke.
UK version, obviously. Not the US version.
How are you reading this? That this belonged to Dayu in life and then reappeared on her bed? Or that it appearing on her bed was the first time it was seen and somehow it was a sign from Dayu and therefore belonged to her?
Yeah, I think the impression that I got was that she had owned it in life, and then through the power of some sort of quasi-supernatural bullshit, it somehow made its way back to her bed.
Yeah, I'm reading it the same way as you are, Ken. I think that's how it's supposed to be believed. Yeah, it swam through the ether.
From the ocean to the bed.
It grew wings or something. I don't know.
In reality, this is bullshit from one end to the other, right? Like, I'm supposed to believe that Dayu had this beautiful mother of pearl pendant, a seven-year-old. In this cult, even a spoiled seven-year-old, that's BS. This was always Mazu's, and she's making this shit up to make it seem like spooky and special.
I'm just curious how Mazu actually ended up with this pendant in the first place.
I genuinely think she just ordered it on some online shopping spree.
She just got it on Amazon?
Yeah.
Yep. Amazon Prime.
Two-day delivery.
My second question is, I'm just curious how it was lost. We know that Becca was behind this, but we are never told if Mazu was in on it or if Becca somehow managed to actually steal it from her. And if she did, how?
You know what? This is so interesting because I had never before considered the idea that Mazu and Becca might have been in on this together.
Yeah.
But now that you've suggested it, it's the only thing that makes sense to me. Now I feel like Mazu must have been behind the whole thing. Becca took the pendant from her and hid it under her orders. That makes perfect sense to me.
Yeah, I mean, it never says that and we're only told about Becca, but that's just because that's all Robin knows. I can't see how she would have done it on her own unless she snuck into Mazu's room while she was sleeping and cut it off, right? But that seems unlikely.
Deeply unlikely. The much more plausible scenario is Mazu and Becca conspiring to fuck over Rowena.
I think 100%. So. If she did do it by herself, it would take a lot of hatred towards Rowena to risk it.
And on the assumption that she did it by herself, maybe she thought that Mazu would have her back trying to pin stealing the pendant on Robin, since Becca thinks that she's a threat to the church. Becca's real high up, like a better to beg for forgiveness than ask for permission sort of thing.
Yeah. But I mean, I think Mazu and Becca are both really just, I think they both see Wace's interest in her. That's what they don't like. They want to get her in the shit so that she's not a new spirit wife.
Now I'm just imagining when Becca goes back, when their plan didn't work and they're in the office together, seething.
Mazu gonna be mad.
I love when it says that Robin scented opportunity here. It's just funny because Becca, and maybe Mazu, did this to get her in trouble. And all it actually resulted in is Robin getting to check one of the tasks off her list.
You know, it feels like a very Strykean description there where it talks about her scenting opportunity. She really does have a fabulous instinct for this stuff, as Stryke would say.
I hope we get more of Stryke complimenting her in The Hallmarked Man.
Me too.
You're good at this detective shit.
And also would really like Robin verbally complimenting him.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Right. You know,
mm-hmm. Now you got me thinking mm-hmm. about blushing bashful strike again. And now,
Oh my God,
I'm dead. I am the skull emoji.
Oh my God. That's what the skull emoji means. It's actually us readers because we've died.
Yep. We've died. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I think mm-hmm. that's what it is.
Robin takes the opportunity to head to the woods and she finds herself at what we now know is where Dayu was killed.
The posts are all neatly chopped down, but in that circle, that's because they brought the pigs there to, you know, right?
Feast on Dayu's mutilated corpse. Yes.
Yes.
That would be why. Yeah.
That's a very gentle way to put it, Kenz. Thank you.
The more that I think about what happened to Dayu, the more that I really hate Abigail. This is so awful. It's so evil.
7-year-old girl.
Yeah.
Yeah, so they had built a pen to keep the pigs contained while they mm-hmm. did that, and then they destroyed it afterwards. But my question is, so how far in advance were they planning this to have the time to gather the materials and then to build a sturdy enough pen in the woods when we know what kind of surveillance this cult has going and how little free time people have here? This must have been an enterprise, you know?
I guess they'll have no problem proving premeditation.
Zero problem. I think mm-hmm. the pen proves it.
Robin also finds a bit of burnt rope, which is sad to think what that was used for. Great, though, that there's so much evidence still left over.
Yeah. So we know that Wace was suspicious of what happened with Dayu, right? Did he never think to go into the woods and have a little peek and see? Because if he'd suspected that Abigail had done something with her, there's only so many places it could have happened, right?
Well, he knew she did.
Yeah, he knew. But did he not want to know 100% for sure
What happened?
Yeah.
I can see this being an ignorance is bliss type situation. Mm-hmm. Like, no one wants to know that their child fed another child to the pigs.
Yeah, not even an asshole like Wace, probably.
Well, it's probably more to protect himself to say, I don't know.
I think you're right there.
And we do know that this is what Midge does later when she sneaks in and gathers some of that evidence.
Yeah.
It kind of reminds me of Robin and Silkworm having to collect the dog poop, you know?
Those were the days.
Just rummaging through bins, not spending 4 months undercover in a brutal, abusive cult.
Yeah.
Okay, now I'm trying to think of like 2, 6, 8 parallels again.
We might have to do some DNA analysis.
Oh, you connected the dots. You did it.
So next is when Jang shows up, which made me feel a bit nervous.
I mean, at least it wasn't Tayo. Jang, I always felt like Robin could deal with.
Yeah, this is a small point. When Robin tells Jang that the posts are like a mini Stonehenge, Jang has no idea what Stonehenge is. I just feel like it's such a good example of how isolated and removed from everything these people are.
It is weird and it's sad. They know nothing.
Yeah,
they have no knowledge because they've grown up in this... I mean, they talk about bubble people. They're the bubble people.
Because they're living in a bubble.
They're living in the bubble. Yeah.
Do either of you have any thoughts about Jang's attitude towards sex? It's very strange. And he says some things that are out of the ordinary for people at Chapman Farm.
Yeah, it was strange to me. Specifically because, so the way he spoke about sex, it felt very pornified, if you know what I mean.
It did, yeah.
The vocabulary, the obsession with lesbian sex. Where did he learn all this? Because it doesn't seem like he'd have internet privileges, you know, to get this kind of very specific niche internet.
Yeah.
I think my best guess was that Tayo was somehow the source of knowledge, either with taunting him with it or bragging about watching lesbian porn. I don't know. It was very odd.
But it is a good point because remember, Emily didn't even know the word blowjob. But
she
here,
Jang has knowledge.
And Robin thinks in the next chapter that his preoccupation with it is likely because he's not allowed in the retreat rooms.
Which makes sense, being obsessed with what you can't have.
Mm-hmm.
Still gross and creepy.
The way that he talks about sex just makes my skin crawl. And his preoccupation with knowing whether or not Robin and Emily are sleeping together, it's like he simultaneously finds it arousing as well as gross.
Yeah.
Which, I mean, tracks given the church's homophobia, I guess. Yeah. You know, when you read that emphasis of, were you a lesbian and were you doing it with her? Like, oh my God.
Exactly. It just doesn't seem that's like this is something that would come out of nowhere in this environment. Like that's a material world thing. Although maybe in Revelation, because Kyle had the whole revelation about being gay. So I don't know.
Maybe.
Although it made me laugh a little when Jang was like, well, if you weren't a lesbian outside, then how did you know where Emily was? Somehow being a lesbian gives you
magical powers to track down women hiding in bathrooms? What?
You didn't know? It's down there, right at the bottom in the fine print.
Well, listen, if this is the case, why, for God's sake, haven't we got some lesbians tracking down Kate Middleton right now?
That's a great question.
Like, if they have honing GPS, then why aren't we doing this?
The whole way that Robin smoothly moves the conversation into flattering Jang and getting him on her side is just incredible.
Yeah, she's been watching Jang this whole time and knows exactly where he ranks with his family. She knew exactly what to do.
It's masterful.
This is going to sound funny, but there's an element of this that reminds me of Survivor. So often on Survivor, they talk about how forming relationships ends up being a major factor in deciding who wins the game. And it's exactly what Robin does. Most of the things that Robin finds out or the small things that end up benefiting her are because of the relationship she was able to build with Jang, Emily, and Will even.
Yeah.
It's just more proof, I think, that she was the right person for the job.
She absolutely was.
I find it so strange when Jang brags about being good at the matching game as a kid and being better than Tayo. It's like he had this one victory in his life and he's holding on to it with everything he has, even if it's just a kid's card game.
Aw, that's actually a bit sad.
It is kind of, yeah.
Shame he's such a colossal dickhead outside of that.
Yeah. I don't hate him as much as I hate Tayo.
Yeah.
But that's a pretty high bar to clear.
Jang points to the tree with the axe and tells Robin not only where it is, but he says that Dayu put it there.
It's very significant that this tree is right near the burned rope and stakes, right? Because those two things are connected.
Yeah. Do we know what the legend is? Why he believes Dayu put it there?
I don't think we do. It could just be a coincidence, though. Like, kids find a weird, creepy thing in the woods, and they say it's Dayu who did it because she's creepy.
It's the creepy connection.
Creepy ghost put the creepy hatchet in the creepy tree.
When Jang starts telling Robin that he's the only person who's realized that there was someone from the farm who had been there before, was I the only one who fell for this and thought it was going to be really important to solving Dai's murder? Because it's not actually important, is it?
Yeah, I don't think that Walter, right, that was his name, being at the church for the two different times ended up being super important. But I think at the time I thought that it was going
to
be.
Yeah. The only thing that this led to was the Rosie Fernsby red herring. So as a red herring, it makes sense that it felt super important because it's supposed to feel that way.
I'm sorry. How is there anyone who's gone to the UHC? Not once.
Yeah.
Not twice. Three times.
Walter is the specific kind of idiocy that you see in career academics. I recognize it very well. And it exists. Oh,
it's mind-blowing.
On the pretense of going to the bathroom, Robin sneaks back to her bed to add her pebble for the day when she realizes that every single one of her pebbles have been knocked to the floor. And this is when she finds Mazzy's pendant underneath her mattress.
This is obviously bad news. Someone wants her in trouble so much, but I was worried that Becca was going to wonder what the pebbles were about.
Mm-hmm. Right?
It doesn't seem like she even noticed them. She probably did it in such a hurry that she wasn't paying attention.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I was worried about that too. Like she was going to catch on to what it was for and eventually try and intercept her on the way to the rock or something.
Oh, no.
Yeah. No.
And then we get this bit where Robin climbs up on the sink to throw the pendant out the window. Mm-hmm. I have to think this is foreshadowing for her escape, right?
Yeah, I think so too. It's Chekhov's window, right?
Explain that for those of us who didn't study literature.
Oh, Chekhov's gun is when there's a gun on stage in the first act. By the third act, someone's grabbing it off the wall and shooting it at someone.
Everything has to have a purpose.
Everything has to have a purpose. And this window has a purpose.
Yep, that was the same impression I got. It was like, oh, yep, that's going to be important in her leaping. Definitely.
I can't wait to get there.
Oh my God, we're so close though.
We are really close.
So the chapter ends with a group of people coming in to search the beds with instructions from Becca to search underneath the mattresses. Becca is about to be really mad when she realizes that her framing Robin did not work.
Well, she's got to be better at it.
Do better, Becca.
I wonder how long it took for Walter to find the pendant in the grass. I kind of hope it took a really long time just so Robin had a free day.
Yeah, you know, just kind of wander around poking at places.
Yeah. Nice little treat for Robin.
Oh, yeah.
All right. Let's go to chapter 70.
In chapter 70, Strike meets up with Bijou, receives some important phone calls, and learns Pat's real age.
Oh, this is such a good chapter.
I love this chapter.
Thus, the superior man pardons mistakes and forgives misdeeds. And that is from Hexagram 40, Deliverance.
There are a couple of mistakes in this chapter Strike could forgive, but I like to think this is primarily talking about Pat's confession.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely agreed. The judgment for these lines says, A thunderstorm has the effect of clearing the air. The Superior Man produces a similar effect when dealing with mistakes. Maybe I just like to combine strike with thunder because it's powerful.
A lightning strike.
Exactly. Continues, when failings come to light, he does not dwell on them. He simply passes over mistakes just as thunder dies away. He forgives just as water washes everything clean. I thought that the image of the storm and the cleansing water was interesting here with Pat's tears and the general water themes, you know?
I do.
And the hexagram itself says that this is the point at which obstacles begin to be resolved. The Superior Man is not yet out of the woods, but this is the turning point where everything that's been stressing Strike out is going to start to be solved.
The chapter starts with Schenker calling to tell Strike that Jordan Rini tried to kill himself after getting a phone call from his wife.
Of course, we know that this phone call was actually Abigail. And let's just jump ahead a little bit here because Strike does call Rainey's actual wife later in the chapter and confirmed that she did not call him.
Do you think that that counts as a troubled blood parallel, determining the legitimacy of a phone call?
Ooh.
Oh, yeah, totally. Clearly, Strike has learned his lesson about double checking where phone calls come from.
That's a good catch. I didn't even think about that one. I'm imagining Abigail complaining to Janice in prison that Strike figured out she was the caller and Janice saying, yeah, sorry, that one's probably on me.
They're Strike villain support
group. Yeah, they're Strike support group, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Love that.
Schenker's way of acknowledging Charlotte's death by saying there's a lot of it, meaning suicide, going around is so Schenker, right? Even Polworth was more emotional and considerate.
You know it's bad when you're making Polworth sound sensitive and thoughtful, right?
Oh, God. Did Schenker ever meet Charlotte? I highly doubt it. When would he have met her?
No, I don't. I mean, I doubt he ever would have. But still.
Yeah, still.
It's funny.
All right. The next phone call that Strike gets is from Bijou.
Oh, yay.
Our favorite.
I'm so annoyed that she says, it's me. I'm sorry.
Hi.
What?
I'm the problem.
Well, yes, Bijou is the problem. It's a true statement there.
It's a true statement.
But what makes her think that she has an it's me relationship with him, especially after what she did?
Seriously, I feel like the only person that he's on a it's me terms with is Robin and maybe Charlotte, but she doesn't count anymore.
She doesn't do a lot of things anymore. When she said that she had to ask Ilsa for his number again, I would have given anything to hear that conversation or Ilsa's rant to Nick about it later.
Oh, to be a fly on the wall, right?
I'm wondering what the hell Bijou could have said to Ilsa to convince her to give that number over. Because at this point, I feel like Ilsa would have been very reluctant.
I bet she probably framed it that he's in a bit of trouble. Or if I don't talk to him, this is going to get worse. Something that would make Ilsa say, okay.
That makes sense.
Bijou asks to meet and she tells him how someone has bugged Humboldt's office and that he thinks that it was Strike.
So he agrees to meet her in the Flying Horse. We know that this was the Tottenham. It's the scene of some really important Strike and Robin moments, mostly just finding each other drunk and heartbroken and helping each other. So one, it's changed its name, of which Strike thoroughly approves. We've talked about this, but this is a sign of change. It's foreshadowing when that happens, 64's change of Strike's heart. He's embracing change.
Yeah.
Two, Strike has a bunch of meetings here in this book with different people specifically.
He does, yeah.
Him and Bijou, him and Pat, the contractors to avoid Lil Jon, and then their police contacts, including Ryan and Robin and all of the tension and Wardle. But it's never just him and Robin alone here, is it? Until he says at the end of this book, I'll be in the Flying Horse. I am more and more convinced that book 8 is going to start with Robin finding him there. And again, when we get to the rescue / escape chapters, there's an epigraph that talks about how he rides in on a winged horse that I think is foreshadowing Robin coming to find him at the Flying Horse at the beginning of 8, because this is the scene of their connection. It's the scene of change. He's having so many meetings here, but he's not having the one meeting that he needs yet. But it's open at the end of the book that he's going to have that meeting.
I mean, I'd love it.
We would love to see it. I'm manifesting it.
You know what I really want to hear her ask him? I just want her to say, did you mean it? I don't know why I keep thinking that. Yes. I keep thinking she's going to say, did you mean it?
Did you mean it? Oh my god.
And he's gonna be like, yeah. Oh god, yes, it kills me.
Obviously. Mm. Or I guess it'd be like Charlotte, right? He's like, Dadoy. About this one thing. Nothing else. She's
it's the only thing she's right about.
One thing mm-hmm. she's fucking right about is that I'm in love with you.
In some way, she's gonna ask for clarification. Do you know what mm-hmm. I mean?
And he's mm-hmm. gonna tell her. And then I'm gonna spontaneously combust on
right.
Stop, drop, and roll.
Stop, drop, and roll. Mm-hmm. Gonna have to have that at the ready.
We have to talk about this because God knows the chatter around this part doesn't die.
Oh, never.
This is when Bijou tells Strike that she's pregnant. And like Strike, I had a brief moment of panic. She quickly says that it's not his, it's Hanbold's. And of course, it is. It is Hanbold's baby, everyone.
Yeah.
And it's not some bit of like clever misdirection that she's going to bring up later. This crap with Bijou was meant to be in this book because the personal always ties in with the case, which, in case anyone's noticed, ends up being all about babies.
Mm-hmm. It is.
And that and the fact that these books are all technically standalone books. I think that when Bijou says that she's pregnant with Hanbold's kid here, we can trust that she and Joe are telling us the truth. Plus, yeah. mm-hmm. as we've said with other implausible theories,
yeah.
I just don't think that that's the story that we're being told. And I have no doubt that we'll be proven right, just like with the Madeline stuff.
Yeah. Yes. And Pools, I know that you have already explained the timeline here, but do you want to do a little review?
So the last time they slept together was, I believe, March 28th. We're now in mid-July. Dating pregnancies goes from the date, the start of your last period. So mm-hmm. if Bijou had been ovulating and gotten pregnant one of the two times they'd slept together, she'd be 18 or 20 weeks now. She'd be showing.
Yes.
The paper just had a picture of her in a form-fitting peacock blue dress. No hint of a pregnancy. It's not 20 weeks along, guys.
Yeah. I went and looked at a picture of me from just when I was pregnant a couple years ago. Mm-hmm. At the 20-week mark, you can definitely see. I sent it to you so you can see. Yeah, it was.
I could see.
That's halfway.
It's
you
halfway.
Can completely see a pregnant belly.
And she's quite slim. There's no hiding it.
Mm-hmm.
Plus, I should note that she had a red wine the last time she and Strike talked in a pub when yes. she'd have been 10 to 12 weeks pregnant.
If it was his.
If it was his. She'd right. have known full well that she was pregnant at this point.
Yes, you definitely
would. And yes, okay.
Would.
We don't actually see her drink the red wine, but it would have been the perfect time for her to pull the I'm pregnant card to get Strike to back down from threatening her, right? And yet she does not.
In addition to that, Bijou was deliberately trying to get pregnant by this one man. Strike mm-hmm. was only a way yeah. to make him jealous. And since Bijou is very aware of what to do to get pregnant, I'm certain she didn't want to get pregnant by Strike because it would ruin everything she was planning.
Mm-hmm.
There's mm-hmm. no way she would have wanted or allowed herself to get pregnant by Strike. It wouldn't have yeah. made any sense for what she was trying to accomplish.
No yeah. sense.
If she had any inkling that from the timing that she was pregnant with Strike's kid instead of Hanbold's, I don't see her keeping it.
And finally, Bijou had a clear purpose to the narrative that has now been fulfilled.
Mm-hmm.
She was the necessary catalyst to Strike's bow. She was last smack in the face that he needed to get him to quit it with the displacement fox, right?
Yeah.
The moment of icy horror that he feels just at the thought of it being his kid is the little cherry on top of this narrative sundae. It's the finishing touch. Her purpose has been served. There's no need to bring in the soap opera pregnancy plot to serve as a roadblock for Strike and Robin, especially this late in the series, and especially when they're so good at building their own goddamn roadblocks.
They don't need any more.
They don't need this in the narrative at all. Mm-hmm. Like, it's not yeah. necessary.
No, that's an excellent point. Mm-hmm. Bijou is never going to be seen again. Maybe reference like how Madeline or Kiara are referenced yeah. sometimes, but it's
nothing more than that.
It's not going to happen. Even if Joe used a DNA emoji, obviously that has to do with the case.
It's always had to do with the case. Every time.
Yes. Her emojis have always had to do with the case.
It says that Strike tells her that he'll think about helping her, not because he felt any sympathy for Bijou, but because an idea had occurred to him that was as unpleasant as it was plausible.
This idea he has is absolutely correct, that Patterson is the one who bugged his office trying to get the goods on Strike.
Mm-hmm.
I love how trying to discredit Strike is the thing that takes Patterson down.
Mm-hmm.
Doesn't that feel like sweet justice?
It does. You play stupid games. You win stupid prizes.
Mm-hmm.
Karma is my boyfriend, etc., etc.
Right.
You know, that's how it goes.
But I think the article that Strike read before where his name is mentioned along with Hanbold's must be how Patterson knew to look for this. Mm. I feel like he probably had a Google alert set up for Strike.
Probably. Now I'm just just imagining Patterson having a bulletin board just covered in stuff about Strike, like they show in Kelsey's bedroom in the TV version of Career of Evil.
Yeah, he's added some little glitter bubble paint to it.
Absolutely, you know it.
Strike, my nemesis forever.
Strike's like, why are you so obsessed with me?
Yeah, that's accurate.
You know, I said a few chapters ago that Bijou reminded me of Charlotte when the peacock blue was mentioned. And here, Strike is also reminded of Charlotte when Bijou stretches her hand across the table to try and touch his hand. Mm-hmm. Again, not a great sign about Bijou's character to be so often compared to Charlotte.
And I know that he's rejected her before, but it still is a good thing to see him rejecting the damaging but familiar part here after 64.
Yes. You're so right.
I'm so proud of this 41-year-old fictional man.
He wants a good person for a change.
He wants something different.
Okay, let's get to this part with Pat, because I know that we all really love this part.
Yeah, there are no words for how much I adore this part. But before we do, Strike caving in and ordering a burger and chips is so incredibly relatable, because there's only so much shit you can stand until you're like, fuck it, I need a burger.
Right. It would have taken me a lot less.
A lot less. Yeah. Like, significantly less stress before I'm caving again the burger.
Mm-hmm. I would just be like, I'm tired.
Burger. I'm tired. I woke up 5 minutes late. Burger.
I deserve this.
I've earned this by doing nothing.
You know what's one thing I really love is when Pat first calls him, he's in a really bad mood. He's close to losing his temper, right? Mm-hmm. But I feel like when she actually shows up and tells him, by the time Pat leaves, he softens.
Yeah, he has. She improved his mood.
Yeah, I think it has to be his affection for her. He has to recognize that she's risking losing her job to tell him this.
Do you not think it's because he's secretly in love with her? I think that's what it really is.
You know what? You're right. That's probably it.
Yep.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
How funny is this line, though? He had a dim idea that if he employed a human resources person, they'd advise him to accede to the request and possibly not to swear at Pat.
Possibly.
Yes, Strike. I think it is very possible that HR would tell you not to swear at your employees.
When Pat gets there and she just blurts out that she's 67, I laughed out loud. Mm-hmm. It's so funny that for 3 books now, we've been reading how she looks 10 years older. And this whole time, it's because she actually was.
Right. Mm-hmm.
It's a great example of J.K. Rowling's excellent ability to plan and leave clues books ahead of something happening.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Man, the sense of relief when she said this was so much that I couldn't help but laugh too. Joe really is brilliant with these small little clues that end up panning out.
I love Strike's response when Pat says she lied on her CV. Yeah, you did. So good. Strike correctly guesses that Little John is blackmailing Pat. And I'm really curious how Little John knew this in the first place. So is this because Strike is correct that Patterson is trying to get dirt on their employees? I would think that Strike and Robin might have run a background check on people they hire, but I guess not. But I'm thinking that Patterson must have done this looking into all of them.
I was wondering this too, but what you've said makes sense. I feel like Strike and Robin really should be running background checks though.
They probably will now.
Yeah, I'd hope so. I wouldn't want them to lose out on like another Pat.
No, of course. It's funny that all Patterson could find was that she's 67.
Right. Like that's the worst you could find.
Oh, no.
The reason Pat is confessing now is because she caught Little John trying to take pictures of some of the files in the office.
Yeah. I love that the thing that drove her to confess was her loyalty to the agency. Her thinking that even though she might get fired, it was worth telling Strike what she had seen was absolute proof of how valuable she is to them. Strike would have never fired her for this. Now,
man, just when I think I can't love Pat anymore, we haven't even gotten to the point where she's taking in Will and Chang and everything.
I know. I do agree with Pat, though, that she had to lie. Mm-hmm. Yeah, we even see Strike complaining, I don't want you to accuse me of ageism in the beginning of Troubled Blood, right? I think she was definitely right to lie.
Yeah, he would have used any reason to be like, and thus been guilty of ageism, by the way. Right. But I also love that we can see here just how upset Pat is at the thought of being fired, because she loves this job.
And them.
And them.
But I love this next bit where Strike says, stop bloody crying. You're not fired. Where am I going to get another manager like you?
Aww. It's so cute. I don't know what you guys think. I think Strike said this intentionally because he's touched by her loyalty. And this is the way he and Pat compliment each other. It's not outright. It's enough.
It's gruff and understated, but very sweet.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I am on the Pat Strike Bro TP for life.
Same girl.
Hell yeah.
This bit, it reminded me a bit of Strike telling Robin to stop crying at Burger King in Silkworm. Yeah. Yeah, yeah, when she's crying into her nap and he's like, stop it, that family's staring at us.
Like, she doesn't give a monkeys.
Yeah, that was really cute.
Oh, I love, that's my favorite chapter of Silkworm.
Mm-hmm.
It's same. Just so cute.
Same, it's adorable. Yeah.
When Strike tells her that she should have told him before, I have no doubt that this also would have been fine, especially with Robin around. Once they had that relationship established, I don't think he would have pushed to fire her over this lie.
He absolutely wouldn't have. She could have told him. You know what she could have told him would be after the bombing.
Because
I feel like saving your boss from like a mail bomb is a get out of jail free card for minor offenses like lying on a CV.
That would have been amazing and hilarious. Imagine the bomb has just gone off. Are you okay? I'm 67.
That would have been amazing. And he's like,
What?
I can't hear you.
My ears are ringing a little bit. Yeah.
Oh, that would have been so funny.
Can you imagine the relief Pat must feel at this, though? Not only is this big secret finally out that she's been keeping for years, but the weight of the tension with Little John has been lifted and Strike is on her side and asking for her daughter's help with the case. She must be so relieved.
She must be. It made me laugh when Pat said she's never off it about her daughter and Facebook because that tracks for that demographic. My question here, if Rhoda's going to help, then doesn't that mean that Pat will have to tell Rhoda where she works?
Ooh.
But she signed an NDA.
Well, maybe she thinks that if Strike is asking for her help, she's going to have to.
She's going to reveal the secret. Is she going to make Rhoda sign an NDA, though?
I could see Pat doing that.
I could
totally see her doing that.
1000% see Pat doing that, yes.
Yeah.
And in this scene, we get Pat calling Strike Cormoran for the very first time.
Oh, that's so cute.
Super cute.
He's usually just him.
Him. That guy.
It's a personal moment for them, right?
It is a very personal moment. And it's very sweet. Can we all have a moment, though, to remember the first time that Robin called him Cormoran?
Oh.
Because I think that we all recall what was going on there.
Bit of belly hair showing.
Mm-hmm.
If I remember correctly.
There were buttons involved that were unbuttoned.
I do seem to remember wrongly. That.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Strike telling her she's brilliant, I believe, was also involved.
Yes. Oh, she was disappointed because she had wanted to go with him.
That was so good. Okay.
I will never forget the first time reading Cuckoo's Calling and just being desperate for him to hire her permanently.
Right?
The whole time I'm reading it, I'm like, please, let's figure this out, you guys. Come on. Mm-hmm. Knowing it was going to happen, but just desperate.
He knew it was going to happen. We always knew.
I didn't anticipate I'd be here 10 years later.
Yes, no one did.
Yeah. Oh,
having emotions.
Strike knew full well he was guilty of an inconsistency. He damned Little John on the principle that where there was one lie, there were more. But he was confident that Pat's lie hadn't been born of a fundamental lack of honesty. Quite the reverse. She was often far too honest for his liking. In the early days of her employment, he'd have jumped at the chance to fire her, but time had brought about a complete revolution in his feelings. Now, he'd have been extremely loath to lose her.
It really reminds me of how he felt about Robin to start with versus later on, where he didn't want her there at first, you know?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Pat was going to be a temporary solution and now is no longer temporary.
I think the process was much quicker with Robin.
Yeah.
Probably helped by how good looking and tactful and not annoying she is to him.
Mm-hmm. It helps.
But they got there.
The boobs helped, is what you're saying.
I'm saying the boobs helped.
Yeah.
I love it whenever Strike is just a cheerful hypocrite. Like, he knows full well he's being hypocritical. He doesn't give a shit. Like at the end of Ink Blackheart, he's like, oh, you shouldn't smoke.
I totally understand this, though. They're very different things.
100% they're different things. I just seem like, yeah, I'm inconsistent. Who gives a fuck? And speaking of loving Strike, this is one of my favorite moments. So it says, nevertheless, he thought, as he reached absently for more chips, he might delay the pay rise he'd been planning to give her. Forgiveness was one thing, but it was a poor management strategy to reward employees for coming clean only when they were forced to do so.
This is one of your favorite parts?
I love it. He's just so Strike, you know?
So I think this is one of those things that Strike and Robin would have handled differently had Robin been around. If they had talked about it, and I think Robin would argue that, you know, the loyalty Pat showed, even when she feared being fired, would be cause for the raise, where Strike is thinking more about the lie.
And Robin would be in the right, I think. You know, if we're going to take sides.
I will argue against this being any sort of bad behavior or management style from Strike, just because this is just a thought he has. It's not something he voiced out loud or scolded her for.
Yeah, it's his inside thoughts, which one should not be judged for the most part.
Right.
He's thinking it to make himself feel better, I feel like. He's like, I'm not a complete softie.
The chapter ends with Strike calling Schenker back and asking for him to trace the call made to Rini before his suicide attempt.
And he offers £1,000 for this. £1,000.
He does.
Very reckless. That's a lot of money.
Well, he's got it.
Yes, technically.
And I think he suspects that whoever is on the other end of that phone call is very important.
True.
So this is worth it for him. I love that we get to end this episode on such a wonderful Pat note.
No,
it's such a good part. And I'm realizing without this confession, she might not wanted Will to come stay with her or had been as open because she wouldn't want Strike and Robin coming around to her place. Maybe this leads to all good things.
It does.
All right. What are we doing next time, Kens?
We are doing chapters 71 through 74. And in those chapters, we see Robin noticing Will's doubt in the UHC, Lynn attempting to terminate her pregnancy, and Robin spotting Barkley removing her letters.
Oh, that chapter still hurts my heart every time.
That'll do it for this episode. Thank you so much for listening. If you enjoy what you've heard, don't forget to follow us on social media. We're on Twitter, Instagram, and Tumblr at the SE Files Pod. You can also contact us on our website at thesefilespod.com or email us directly at sefilespodcast@gmail.com. Thank you so much again for listening, and we hope to catch you next time for another episode of the Strike and Ellicott Files.